It is then necessary to use the mind primarily to reveal its own shortcomings to itself. By this revelation of shortcoming, which the mind grudgingly brings in, it never does so enthusiastically. It does, however, gain a new insight into itself. Simple example, a man walking across a bridge that looks a little rickety, gets out in the middle, thinks it over, and says, "I think I can make it." So he continues his way across, the bridge collapses, and he drops into a muddy stream underneath. As he gets out of the water, he rather sadly reflects to himself, "I guess I was wrong." Now, in this simple circumstance, the mind has rebuked itself. Nothing new has been added. The individual thought the bridge was strong enough. By experience, he found out that the bridge was not strong enough. Therefore, he knew his thought was wrong. In this tangled procedure of existence, we make such useful discoveries every few minutes. And in the course of time, we come gradually to more and more negative conclusions about the mind. The more we trust our weight upon it, the more we discover ourselves in trouble. Now, why should this be if the mind is factual? The reason why it is true is that while the mind itself is factual according to its own knowledge, the person using the mind is living in an outer universe, a material existence, most of the facts of which are not available to the mind. We do not, as yet, have the answers to hardly any of the basic physical questions of existence. We have some kind of explanation, but almost every year science overthrows one of its own conclusions. Science is a kind of mental process using the same coordinating instrument. And science is supposedly able to teach itself because it is theoretically willing to admit its own mistakes. It remains close to its facts, and when these are proven wrong, it drops them. Man, however, in the same position, when proven wrong, clings to his error and dies with it. The coordinator is therefore able to discover its own inadequacy. It tries to apply the common knowledge and finds this inadequate. It tries to apply personal experience, but finds that an experience is never actually identically repeated. Therefore, there is always something in the new situation that the old experience did not quite take care of. Then we have to race on to some kind of judgment about it. And in this problem of adapting old experience to new problems, the possibility of error again intrudes. We cannot, with absolute certainty, say that the mind of man is capable of making him happy here and now in this world. If it is not able to do this, then man must either accept misery or must find some way to remedy the situation within his own mind. Nearly all of the ancients agreed that ignorance was the common cause of all disaster. And ignorance is simply a mental coordinating machine with no cards being fed in. And as a result of that, the wheels are going around desperately and nothing comes out. The reason nothing comes out is that nothing went in. There's another type of thing also in which if enough cards are fed in that are themselves inaccurate or incorrect, that which comes out will compound the felony. So ignorance is always the individual not knowing anything, or not knowing the right thing, or desperately conceiving that he knows something that is not true. Any such informations as this, or misinformations, period, will certainly come out with a wrong answer. Man's mind, therefore, of itself, is continually revealing its own inadequacy. This inadequacy is viewed by consequences. The man who found the bridge broke under him, heard the noise of the breaking, which was contributed to the brain by the ears, and the sudden feeling of being wet, which was contributed by the sense of feeling. He also had his mouth full of water, which contributed to the sense of taste. He saw himself falling, so that his eyes and sight were affected. And in all probability, he also had the smell of stale water from the millpool underneath. All of this evidence was taken back by the sensory perceptions to the coordinator. The coordinator sifted all this through its mechanism and came out with the inevitable conclusion that the bridge wasn't strong enough. You could hardly get away from it. But as it had previously solemnly pronounced that the bridge was strong enough, the coordinator itself is in a dilemma, and the individual dependent upon it can only conclude that the quality of the conclusion reached by the mental coordinator in man is dependent upon the quality of the information which it receives, and not too much can be expected of it at any given time or under any given group of circumstances. Buddha went to work on this problem in connection with his idea of the aggregates, the various experiences which pouring into man provide the units from which judgment is compounded. It actually, all experience has to come in not only through the sensory perceptions, but through certain other channels of acceptances. If we were sure that every time an individual saw or heard something on the outside of his nature, that the true, perfect, inevitable, and accurate record of these occurrences would pass immediately to the coordinator, we could have more comfort and consolation, but this is not the case. In the process of passing into consciousness, all experience is subject to the vitating process of interpretation. The individual does not honestly accept experience. In most cases, he has to interpret it. By the time he has gotten through distorting this experience to meet his own preconceptions, that which goes into the coordinator is already morally and ethically and rationally dishonest. Buddha tells us, therefore, that one of the first things we have to do in trying to help this mental process to function is to stop cheating on it. Stop forcing it to be what it should not be. Stop trying to fool it. And also, stop feeding it attitudes and opinions and notions that are not valid. Because if you feed in things which are not true, conclusions that are not true must come out. And when they come out, they will be much more impressive than when they went in, but they will be no truer. To achieve this correction of basic ignorance, there are certain disciplines which antiquity set up, not for the redemption of a god in man. The ancient didn't believe that you had to educate a god in the human soul. What you had to educate was the inside of man himself. For it was not from any god that his trouble sprang, but from himself. Buddha then took the attitude that we must divide or decide in ourselves values. What are we going to ask of this coordinator? What are we going to demand of it? Are we going to demand that every man be a Socrates? Are we going to insist that every one of our children will be a genius? Are we going to stand by and over-educate young people who need to know how to work much more immediately than they need to know Latin verbs? What are we going to do with these factors in our own natures? Buddha recommended very strongly that the human machine, this coordinator, is able to take over a common, reasonable task and perform it in a reasonably efficient manner if we will just stop overloading it and expecting it to perform miracles. Thus, we seem to see something that we don't really appreciate much these days, and that is the strange and wonderful dignity of the commonplace. All of the opinions of our world are made by minorities, and the great majority of mankind goes on unheeded. And yet there may well be more genius in the commonplace than there is in the exceptional. For ages we have recognized the strange integrity of the folk. Our wonderful honesties rest in simple people. How the world's securities have for centuries been maintained by what we commonly call the middle class of people. The people who were sound within themselves, who had principles, who lived within their means, who made no pretenses to virtues they did not possess. They lived simply, and they lived naturally, and they expressed themselves in the simple words they understood. And they were truly the salt of the earth. Every civilization that has ever has collapsed because of the corruption of its middle class. And this middle class, therefore, may be likened to a moderate-sized machine, a coordinator that is probably all man really needs. Certainly a coordinator which ages of evolution have made available to him. If he doesn't crowd it, if he doesn't pack it, if he doesn't try to run it too fast, if he doesn't attempt to cheat on it, this coordinator will serve reasonably well. It must, however, be given proper care, proper guidance. The machine must be kept in good order. And most of all, it must be operated by a trained operator. If you don't have that tossed into the situation, your repair bills are going to greatly exceed your original investment. So we have the operator that has to run this machine. Though in this particular case, the operator himself seems to be almost part of the machine. But the operator is a level of intelligence originating from the machine, but strangely separated from it by a certain overall experience which the machine itself cannot completely convey. So the operator is the testimony of the machine plus insight, plus understanding, plus intuition, plus imagination from which most of the others came, plus the power to sense in some way that the information provided by the machine is not intended to be thrown away afterwards. This marvelous machine is not intended merely to amaze us. It is intended to provide us with information that we intend to use. And it is only when we begin to bring all these factors together that the information begins to operate as it should. The Buddha, taking this problem of the mental coordinator, began by pointing out that we have to get the rust out of it, perhaps replace a few badly worn or damaged parts, make sure that it is adequately greased, make sure that it is adjusted properly, and having done these things which are necessary to every machine, then proceed to use it wisely. To achieve this, of the bringing of the machine into order, Man must estimate, weigh, and measure the ignorance factor, not only in himself, but in the whole world in which he lives. He must realize that the information that comes out of the machine immediately takes on moral overtones. We use this information in some way. If we use this information correctly, it gains for us further information. If we use it incorrectly, it causes for us misery, which also is recorded in the machine itself. So the machine is changing every minute, recording something different every minute. But this changing, shifting, balancing, coordinating is so confusing that the average person has no way of determining the real procedures. And he has to wait until certain mysterious symptoms, symbols, intensities or pressures seem to float into his objective consciousness, whereby he is impelled to conduct or action of some kind. The mental coordinator, being what it is, the person must simplify all reactions. He must realize that this machine can be used to build with or to destroy with, that it can contribute to his honesty or make him a careful, skillful, and meticulous thief. It can bring out evidence that will make him love man and God or hate both. But what comes out can only be according to what goes in. Every verdict must be the reasonable interpretation of the factors involved. And this type of verdict often leaves the person on the horns of a dilemma. One mistake begins to breed another. One excess suggests another. And the coordinator goes right along, providing us with all the information which is natural to it about these things, and with no moral compunctions whatsoever, because it doesn't have any. But the occurrences themselves that follow these applications of specialized knowledge have moral consequences in terms of life. So the coordinator, with its sensory perceptions, is suspended in a mysterious way between two conditions of being. The lower condition is the material universe, which is a completely lawful sphere in which the laws themselves are for the most part concealed. The confusion of phenomena obscures the natural directions of nearly everything in the physical world. The laws are there, but we cannot see them. We cannot immediately grasp them. Beyond and above the coordinator is an inflexible and inevitable fact in law itself. The coordinator, therefore, has no actual say in the kind of a world in which it is going to live. It can only say what will happen to the person living in the world as it is, and reacting variously to the stimulation of the calculator or the coordinator. The only answer that the coordinator finally comes to of itself is that through long and patient observation and reflection, it becomes evident that all knowledge, all facts, all conclusions arrive in the end at helpfulness or destructiveness. That all things either bring with them security or cause insecurity. Wherever a security, a well-being, an obvious progress is achieved, the conclusion is called good. Wherever it is obvious that the results are tragic, unfortunate, and miserable, then we assume that the consequences of that process are bad. So everything that the coordinator does leads to something, leads to an application, which in turn has implication. Thus, Buddha tells us that the individual must use the coordinator itself to slowly organize his material relationships with existence. Now, he must then call upon the different levels of the coordinator. The highest level of it is the abstract level. And here, the facts are usually known only by tradition. But into this higher level are certain abstract convictions, beliefs, or ideas that seem to have great validity. These must be called upon. Also, there is a middle level in the coordinator, in which it is obvious that growth or change moves things, upward or downward, towards the better or toward the worse. And there is the lower level of the coordinator, which simply concerns itself with creature comforts, which concerns itself with immediacies, in which the immediate takes precedent over the real, and the instant dominates eternity. Now, these different levels, each has experience according to itself. And the individual has to work through these levels through the patient guidance of the machine by which he thinks. Having realized that he can do things for this machine and to it, that in his rage he can break it, or that because he is a good operator, it will last longer in his keeping, whereas if he is a callous operator, defects appear much sooner in the mechanisms. He has much to do with maintaining the efficiency of the instrument. And for him, in his daily living, efficiency means the increase of the factual and the truthful content and the gradual building into the coordinator of things which, when they come out, will be pleasant, happy, constructive, and useful. If, then, we take into this coordinator an overwhelming grief, or an overwhelming grievance, the wheels go round, and in the end there comes out something that is morbid and unsatisfactory and destructive to our peace of mind. There's only one way in Buddhism to prevent this, and that was to stop the inflow of it, to gradually reduce the intensities of the things which bombard the calculator. Thus, Buddha holds out for fact, but not for the exaggeration and the distortion of fact. He points out, for example, that there is no reason why men should not be comfortable. There is no virtue in misery, even for great causes, unless it's absolutely necessary. But the individual cannot afford to make comfort his total purpose for life. When he is willing to sacrifice honor for comfort, he's in a bad way. Therefore, he has to determine the amount of intensity that he can afford to bestow upon any one of these factors or coordinating elements. If he is able to gradually reduce his own illusions about things, illusions which arise not only because the coordinator is organizing existing information, but because it is carrying the karmic load of previous information. The individual comes into this world for only one reason, namely because he is ignorant. So this is a disillusioning thought. Yet very few people in their right mind can ultimately come to the conclusion that they are here in reward for something. There seems to be only one excuse for being here, and that is that there's something the matter with us. The more we know people, the more we come to the common conclusion that we're all in a little trouble. For we have not excellence of penetration and perfection of judgment to start with. We haven't fallen from perfection into our present state. We are slowly climbing out of imperfection, one awkward step at a time. That's the reason why we are here. Because we are here, we can improve. And the individual who can no longer find any grounds for improvement is dead already. Having decided that we can improve, we must discover how. In what way and by what means? Buddha says that we can improve definitely by getting emotion and pressure out of our relationships with life. As long as every relationship between the coordinator and the outer life is pressured by the inordinate intensities of the sense perceptions, we will never get a faithful judgment or an honest report on anything. The only way we can really feed the coordinator useful knowledge is by making a program out of finding this knowledge, doing something with it, and providing it in an attractive, usable form to the coordinating factor. If we wish to study botany, we can, in 8 or 10 years of specialized study, feed into this coordinator enough specialized botanical knowledge so that we can make this field our profession, can gain some reputation in it, and can, upon demand or upon our own interest, identify countless forms of plant life, understand at least the outer forms of their processes, and gradually we'll gain some insight of other things from our great familiarity with plant life. Burbank discovered many wonderful fragments of universal philosophy from his love of plants. But Burbank worked with plants. He learned the facts. He fed these facts into the coordinator. And as a result, he came out with judgment, understanding, and security so far as those facts were concerned. But when he was asked to come down to San Francisco and take a pulpit and preach in a church, Mr. Burbank didn't have his facts anymore. It wasn't his world. Somebody took it for granted that because Burbank was a good man in horticulture, he should make an excellent preacher. That is the burden of being famous. You're expected to know many things you can't possibly know. As a result, Burbank said things which were totally inconsistent with his own convictions. He was so confused as a timid little old gentleman who had no experience with these things that he couldn't be heard beyond the third row, which was perhaps just as well. And he went home heartbroken and misunderstood, and an unkindly press made a miserable situation for him, simply because he was totally out of his field. Now, this happens to everyone. We are all totally out of our fields if we go beyond that which is the common knowledge which we have attained. But we can specialize various areas in the effort to become more proficient in those things most needed at this time for our growth and integration. If we are willing to spend 12 to 14 years learning engineering or astronomy, or biology, we should certainly realize that we must spend similar effort and similar time in the process of actually creating an adequate mental coordinator. This will not be handed to us on a silver platter. We are not assured of it because our parents were brilliant people. We are not in any way safe as far as our mental equipment is concerned until experience itself proves that we have a large measure of common sense. The problem, then, is to cultivate it, to develop it, to feed into this integrator, this coordinator, the type of information which will result in a well-ordered life. That by the constant procedure of physically experiencing contact with other things, we come to valid conclusions about the meaning of this type of contact. We are not deceived by appearances. We are not victimized by the intensities of our own emotions. We do not blame other people because we are in trouble because of our own ignorance. We realize that between ourselves and the things we want to be and the coordination that we want to have, are the three deadly enemies of integration: ignorance, superstition, and fear. As long as these dominate conduct, and as long as ulterior motive dominates practice, the coordinator is going to be corrupted. Because it is corrupted, it cannot serve us, and we cannot depend upon it. Either the person has to have an orderly, integrated, constructive process of thinking, or else he is going to be victim to the miseries of his own mental mistakes. We see this every moment as we go along. We see the individual under the intensities of some pressure within himself, dedicating his life to useless ends. We see him passing along as a spectacular, meteoric success, only to experience at the same time the miseries of broken families, broken health, and broken home. These various processes in which the coordinator gives false judgment all lead to trouble. Buddha pointed out that the greatest false judgment that the coordinator can possibly feed out to us, coming in turn from the greatest misinterpretation of phenomena that we can feed into to the coordinator, is that the material world is a tremendously important, utterly vital sphere, and that success here is everything, and failure here is the most desperate dilemma that we can face. Buddha was convinced that this attitude, which is too widespread, was simply, basically false. And in order to prove it was false, he fed a number of facts into his own coordinator and came out with some rather interesting conclusions. We can say clearly that they are conditioned conclusions. He believed that a certain thing was going to come out, and it did. On the other hand, other people who didn't believe have also put the same facts through their coordinator and have come out with his answer. So that in probability, he had at least the wisdom or the insight to hold attitudes which were very close to the facts, which is one of the most happy things that can happen to a person. Buddha pointed out that if this tremendous intensity with which we lock ourselves into material existence was valid, then we would not and could not be created as we are. We could not be brought into this world with the hazards of this world and forced to pass through the various experiences of this world. And finally, having gained in some measure or some degree the respect of the world, or at least its fear, in the midst of our successes, in the midst of our achievements, we are cut down. Actually, as Buddha pointed out, the whole pageantry of this world is summed up in a simple statement: man is born, man suffers, and man dies. You can add some garnish here and there. You can wrap it in tinfoil. You can tie ribbons around it, but these are the facts. And they are the facts that most people desperately, relentlessly reject. They reject them by ignoring them. They reject them by living in complete nonconformity with them. They continue every strategy that they have as though they were going to be able to go on with it forever. And as I've mentioned once before, I know a case where a man foreclosed his mortgage on his deathbed. He could get a few more dollars that way. And strange as it may seem, this man had no heirs. He just realized that he could sit up once more and make another dollar and then drop back into oblivion. Why? What is the purpose? What has gotten into man by means of which he has allowed the coordinator to be so completely hypnotized by the various projects which men have set up among themselves that he has lost all sight of the impermanence of everything, that he has lost all sight of the fact that he is here today and gone tomorrow. And with the freeways as they are, tomorrow may be sooner than he thinks. With a philosophy of life that can only mean anything if he lives forever, he also cheerfully kills himself and others, trying to save a few seconds in rapid transit. 40,000 persons are killed every year in automobile accidents alone, most of which are preventable. But nobody cares. Here we have a world in which we do not know where we came from, most people. We do not know why we are here, and we haven't the slightest idea of where we are going, if anywhere. And yet we build in this little oasis a completely nonsensical system of existence. A system that makes sense to no one, but is sanctified by the veneration of ages. Buddha said this acceptance of this system, this belief that it has to be right because it had always been that way, the fact that we have to be in style because otherwise we are ridiculous, causes us to overlook the fact that the style itself is ridiculous. And that by following it, we can only look worse than we did before. Everything is according to a pattern based upon the approval of other foolish people for the foolish things that we do. On one occasion in the forum, Socrates was discoursing when the audience broke into violent applause. He turned quickly to one of his disciples and said, "What foolish thing have I said? They are all applauding me." Taking it for granted that they would only applaud error. Actually, we have to face a very interesting fact that we can make the mistakes that everyone makes. We can share in the foolishness of whole generations, but the payment we must face alone. Whatever we do wrong, no matter how many other people slap us on the back and say how wonderful we are, if we have broken a law, we must pay the penalty of that law alone. In those hours, all the backslappers can do us no good. And if we have neglected facts and truths and are stricken down with some helpless or hopeless ailment, the fact that other people applauded what we previously did is of no importance whatsoever. We have to keep the rules if we want to escape from the solitary suffering that follows all broken law. Buddha then suggested we get these things down to size, where we can see them, where we can work with them, where we can do something about them in the daily existence of our own needs and the daily experience of our own problems. The mental coordinator should be fed the simplest possible arrangement of factors. Nothing should be fed into it that we do not want to have come out of it. And no matter whether we will or not, anything and everything will be fed into it that is sustained by the intensity of our own emotional or mental energy. Whether we are conscious or not, every hate and every love will be fed into that machine. Whether we know it or not, everything we think is wonderful will be fed in as something wonderful. Everything we think is terrible will be fed in as something terrible. And because the wonderful and the terrible arises not from fact but from opinion, we are not sure to what degree these various elements deserve the pressure which has been bestowed upon them, and this pressure which in turn must later powerfully influence future conduct. So keep the pressures low. Meet all things in life as quietly as possible. Because this coordinator also speeds up when we demand things from it. And when we demand hasty conclusions from the coordinator, the processes are not accurate. Keep the pressures quiet. Lower the need for mental solution by keeping out of the problems that cause the need for mental solution. Now, some will say this sounds like a very dull life, that the individual is really having a wonderful time because he is rolling around in an ocean of his own intensities. But he's not. He's seasick and always has been in this kind of transportation. What he really means is that there is no demand upon him. He can do as he please. He doesn't have to use his willpower. And he is not contemplating what will happen 5 years later as a result. Take it as it is. Let the future take care of itself. But the future is catching up to him every minute. The coordinator who is best equipped and best solved when we keep the pressures low. Though it doesn't mean that we can't have interesting things. Psychology is discovering today, for instance, that pressure is not at all a synonym of real depth of feeling. Very often the deepest and most wonderful experiences of our lives are very quiet, very simple experiences. We get much more excited over trivia than we do over real issues. We can be angry with 100 trivial occurrences and resent a million different small, nagging incidents. But when the average person of reasonable maturity is confronted with a really great problem, one of the great moments of life, he's usually quiet. He usually meets this with a great depth of determination that is not emotional, that is not pressure-ridden, but has a strange, devout decision in it. Very often in old times, in these great moments of life, man had recourse to prayer. He asked divine guidance. Prayer is disappearing from most modern homes, unfortunately. And in its place, we have greater intensity. Most neurotics have forgotten how to pray. They have no longer the ability to simplify, to place anything in the hands of God or any superior power. They have to carry the full load of their own miseries themselves, and they're inadequate because they've never built anything in the coordinator to solve misery. They've only fed it with misery from the beginning. To simplify, to clarify, to reduce pressure means actually to bring all the values of life into complete focus. We can do anything we want to and do it beautifully and graciously and conveniently. If we stop forcing, if we stop pressing, and if we begin to graciously use the powers and faculties that we possess, so we take things more quietly, more easily, and as a result, we think more on a constructive level. Because we are a little less intense, we are not so sure that everyone else is wrong. Because we do not nurse a hatred so powerfully, we do not entirely forget that our adversary has his virtues. Little by little, the moderation of these intensities makes possible the realization of facts. And we come to the final conclusion that the fact is that nothing is all right and nothing is all wrong. Having thus taken the edge off of these tremendous upheavals which force a mass of erroneous statistics upon the coordinator, we find that the processes of the machine itself begin to smooth out. The answers are no longer dogmatic. They are suggestive answers, things to help us. The conclusions are no longer infinite and inevitable. Rather, they reveal rather clearly that they are according to the facts available. They are not dogmatic. They always allow that other facts could exist and undoubtedly do exist. But little by little, by this procedure, we reduce our living to a reasonable, practical, livable level. We find pleasure in things that do not entirely agree with us. We get a new concept of this problem of togetherness. To us, togetherness means that the other person must have the same allegiances that we have, must agree with us, must like what we like, must dislike what we dislike. And this is especially a problem for children in divided homes. Actually, togetherness means nothing of the kind. Togetherness means that neither person is an egotist. And by this virtual law alone, they can get together very pleasantly. It is never a problem of somebody being always right and somebody being always wrong. As soon as we get rid of that tremendous false overtone of infallibility, which we do not merit, we will find that it is possible to share differences and in that way enrich both persons. We are not really benefited because other people think the same way we do. We are benefited when other people can lead our thinking, not in their direction, but in the direction of a greater truth. The adventure of sharing new ideals is the real privilege of togetherness. But today it depends largely upon the fact that one person has a dogmatic attitude and the other one accepts it. This is about the same type of togetherness that we used to find in the two horses on a beer truck, where one horse did all the pulling and the other horse led him. And this is the way it has always been. In the working with this mental coordinator, which is not a person, but a process in our personality, it is just as surely the monument to our collective nature as our physical possessions are monuments to our ingenuity or our tenacity in certain areas of activity. As we build houses, so we build characters. As we grow, we develop new internal attitudes which help us to grow further. And growth is a process that begins wherever you start. At any moment, the individual can begin to improve the processes of his own consciousness. He can do it by relaxing away from the various intemperances and intolerances of attitudes which lock the coordinator. He can develop an open mind, a seeking mind, a searching mind. He can rejoice in new ideas instead of trying to exterminate them. He can be glad that other people do not agree with him, but hopes that everyone of good sense agrees with themselves to at least a reasonable degree. If we had this type of thing, we would have no religious intolerances. We would have none of the race intolerances that burden us. For all intolerances represent some defect in the proper attitudes of the mind. And where the mind is so perversely affected that it cannot find solutions, it then begins to create antagonisms and discords. If man had devoted of half the energy to the solution of his problems that he now expends in objecting to other people, the race would be in the golden age long ago. But we cannot break through these patterns. And unless we do, we live and die with them. And the person who says that this mind is himself is correct to the degree that it represents the sum of his present attainment. But if he says, in speaking of his mind, that it is an infallible, sacred, spiritual self within him, upon which he can have absolute dependence, this is not true. The only thing he can depend on is that the results of action will be consistent with the causes. And wherever a person is in trouble, the causes have caused the trouble. And we are either happy, adjusted people, or we need to grow. And the only way we can grow is by recognizing this need and accepting it as more important than the continual perpetuation of thoughtlessness. The moment we find that our lives are not happy, we know that our facts are not straight. And by taking this seriously to heart and going to work with it, we begin to clear up things. And when things begin to clear up, we feel better. Our friends feel better. Our neighbors feel better. And little by little, a betterness of this kind extends out into society. Society is changed not by mass motion, but by the improvement of the internal coordination of the individual. When enough people are right, the world is right. And when we are right, essentially right, we are in agreement. Therefore, the fact that the world is in agreement on very little indicates that the world is not right about very much. And because we are inconsistent in our own dedication, we are not very sure. And we have to look with a suspicious eye at that machine and begin to wonder whether we can afford the extravagance of letting it go along without leadership, without guidance, without purpose, and without capitalizing on its product. We therefore seriously feel that each individual should think through, with the coordinator itself, the consequences of this expensive and luxurious piece of equipment, and make sure that in practical terms it is paying for itself. If it isn't, it's up to him to see that it does. Well, we'll now go home and examine our coordinators. Thank you very kindly. We'll see you next week.